And welcome to Sitfa Speaks. This is our last episode of 2022, and we are celebrating Sitfa's new anti-corruption compendium and also the new integrating care publication that Sitfa will be releasing next week. First of all, we'll hear from John Baker, who is an anti-fraud and corruption expert. Up next, it's Nieves Zuniga, who is a research and evaluation consultant who discusses anti-corruption and fraud. And finally, we'll hear from Ellie Roy and Andy Burns, who discuss Sitfa's new integrating care publication that will be published on the 5th of December. Up first, it's John Baker.
Hi John, and welcome to Sitfa Speaks. Do you want to start by introducing yourself and telling our listeners a little bit about your experience in the anti-corruption field?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the invitation. My name's John Baker. I've worked in the anti-corruption field for about 25 years now. Worked through a number of organisations through public sector, including Sitfa themselves as their fraud advisor. Worked my way through private sector accountancy firms, heading up broad and anti-corruption teams across the globe.
Wow, so it sounds like you've had quite a varied and exciting career so far.
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's taken me across the world, really. I've worked a lot in Africa, in Asia, and yes, sort of worked in all sectors, so public, private, not-for-profit, but also in industries such as sport, shipping, mining, and various others. So I guess working in those sort of environments and those different industries has given me sort of a wide experience, I guess, of corruption investigations and also helping organisations embed anti-corruption strategies.
Sitfa has just published its anti-corruption compendium, which brings together a wide range of case studies from around the world, which have all used different approaches to tackle corruption. And you were instrumental in helping to put that compendium together. I think it's interesting to note that the guide starts off by acknowledging that corruption exists everywhere. All parts of governments, organisations and cultures face different levels of exposure to corrupt behaviour. So is corruption endemic? Will we ever wipe it out? Or is the journey of tackling it just as important as the destination?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think we have to be realistic, and to say that we will one day wipe it out is perhaps ambitious. I think what we can do, we can certainly reduce corruption and put in place strategies, policies and cultures through training, mentoring and other things, and the use of technology to drive it down. But I think knowing how humans operate, you know, where there's money, there will always be corruption. So I think to try to go for a ground zero and wipe it out, the only way you're going to do that is stop operating. And obviously that's not an option. So it's all about risk management and deciding what the tolerance is within your organisation for corruption and doing as much as possible to actually drive it down without impacting too much on operations. I say, because for me, both fraud and corruption, I've often said to clients, they say, we want you to stop corruption in our organisation. I say, well, that's really simple. I can do it in 15 minutes. And they go, oh, wow, that's brilliant. What are you going to do? I says, well, we'll just close down, because otherwise it's not going to happen. So let's be realistic and think what we can do reasonably to reduce it, because you're not going to stop it. So a bit depressing, but I guess that's the truth.
So corruption is every bit as human nature as breathing, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's it. I always look at the sort of population, and there's some maxims that 10% of the population are absolute angels and will never do anything wrong. 10% will always do something wrong, and they probably take up the 70% of law enforcement's time. And then the other 80% is very much on the historic fraud triangle, pressure and opportunity. And whilst today, I may be totally honest, I can pay my mortgage, I can pay my bills. Certainly as the economic clampdown's coming down, people are forced into doing things perhaps that they would not have thought of. You know, if you look at things like energy, electricity and gas, I suspect the amount of people bypassing meters now will go up. And they're probably people who historically haven't been criminals or fraudulent, but we've got to survive, and to survive kicks in other things, and your ambitions, to be totally honest, may diminish as you fail to pay your mortgage or heat the house.
That's an interesting point, and it reminds me of a line in the guide that corruption is motivated by need and greed. or they are the main drivers of corruption. But as you just mentioned, people are going to be forced into committing corrupt behaviour and breaking the law because of the economic downturn. So that's because of need. But does some corruption happen not because of need or greed, but just because of neglect or a lack of understanding of rules or processes?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I've investigated cases of both need. I worked in social security for a long time as an investigator, and there were certainly very obvious cases of need that drove people to do that. Whereas I've seen greed. I've worked in other industries. I remember one case in particular. There was a chap, he committed a massive procurement fraud. He already had a blue Lamborghini with an orange interior, and his wife wanted an orange Lamborghini with a blue interior. Now, that to me is greed, not need. I think it is down to education and telling people and informing people what's right, but also allowing them to be compliant as well. I've seen many things go wrong, perhaps around, you know, particularly around procurement and other controls, where to comply is so difficult because of the regulations and the policies that they have to go through, that it's easier to absolutely not adhere to it. Now, those people aren't necessarily corrupt. It's just that they're trying to do business in an almost impossible world, and therefore circumnavigate the controls to actually get the job done. And that can create, you know, a corrupt organisation quite quickly.
You mentioned how important education is, and we'll come to that later in the interview. Corruption can obviously affect organisations both in the private and public sector. It can affect them financially and it can affect their reputation. But for the public sector specifically, what do you think are some of the risks and consequences of corruption?
I think the way the public and private sector come together can be quite interesting, particularly when you look at public sector budgets. It's quite an attractive place to be if you're a private sector contractor or supplier. So there's a great deal of effort goes into winning work in the public sector. And then that brings you into some of the things like gifts and hospitality. And that's a very sort of thin line between gifts, hospitality and bribery. And I've certainly seen many instances where, you know, the public sector, very enshrined in policies, you know, integrity, codes of conduct, and then it collides with, you know, private sector ambition to win work. And what can start off as a very small, perhaps, gifts and hospitality can then incrementally creep. And I've certainly been involved in investigations that have started off with simple, you know, a few pints after work, to going for a curry, to going for a game of golf, to then having a box at, you know, a Premier Football League, to then going overseas to have a game of golf. And then before you know it, the public sector member of staff is being dragged into what is a corrupt behaviour, and possibly too late.
Corruption thrives in times of confusion and uncertainty, and the global pandemic is an excellent example of that. As governments around the world raced to compete for limited PPE and equipment, they often found themselves out of pocket, having paid millions for dodgy goods, or in some cases, goods which didn't even turn up. Were these actions justified in the face of a national and global crisis, or should government have been more careful about its procurement processes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really really interesting one to answer. It's good being sitting here in my office, being able to answer it and not in front of a select committee or something. I mean, I think it would be far too easy for me to say, oh, yes, you know, procurement should have gone through absolutely the 100% process and everything should have gone through properly. Absolutely. In a perfect world, when you're faced with what was a global pandemic, nobody knew how it was going to pan out, you know, emergency procedures, then I can easily understand why some of the controls and the processes were loosened up. Now, I think what should happen is, obviously, whenever any emergency procedures come in, they should be treated as emergency, and then obviously reviewed far more heavily than a normal procurement. So yes, I can see why decisions were made urgently, and perhaps some, you know, decisions that were made quite poorly. I think where it needs to be is that they should have been revisited a lot earlier, and there should have been a lot closer scrutiny on anything where controls were dropped. And we see it all the time where pressures in industry come on and controls have to be loosened. But, you know, they should never just be dropped and forgotten about. They should be monitored far more closely. You know, get the job done. Obviously, you know, like the PPE purchase, people needed it urgently, but you should never lose sight and think, oh, well, you know, we've let the contract, let's forget about the contract. It's been let under what was, you know, quite unusual terms. So let's keep an eye on it and make sure it's proceeding properly and start catching up on the checks, you know, the declarations of interest, the conflicts of interest, the pricing and all those things, and keep a firm hand on it and not just think, well, we got the job done, you know, thank goodness, and move on. It should be observed.
The CIPFA Anti-Corruption Compendium details 9 distinct areas of practice that can be used to effectively prevent corruption. They include embracing new technology, strong leadership, and culture change. Running throughout all of these areas is the idea of education and training. Why is education so powerful in the prevention of corruption?
I think education is so important because people really need to understand what's right and what's wrong, what's allowable and what's not allowable. And without those guidelines, people will just go and do their own thing. So I think the training and mentoring as well shouldn't sit just at practitioner level, but it should be extended through the supply and financial chains as well, so that everybody has a part to play in understanding the damage corruption causes, and also understand what to look out for and how to report it. So what I've been seeing in some of the instances is around sort of the youth culture picking up on the damage that corruption causes, perhaps in much the same way as climate change has been championed. So I think with education, particularly around youth, I think it encourages much more challenge, perhaps, than the old guard would have used. And certainly the use of social media, far more dynamic and organic. So I think if you can start to get that education in place and catch them whilst they're young almost, then I think that's a massive, massive bonus. So it should form, I think, part of any induction, certainly within a workplace. You know, anti-fraud and anti-corruption should feature heavily. And as I said, in maritime, they're now educating sea cadets, and, you know, who may be captains or, you know, ship's masters in 10, 20 years' time. And corruption's already on their agenda. So I think it's absolutely essential.
The guide brings together some really positive, creative and inspiring examples of work being done all over the world to fight corruption. Too often the fight against corruption is framed as an uphill battle that seems hopeless at times. So what can we here in the UK take away from these examples in the guide, and what can we learn from them?
I think it's understanding that things, you know, come back to your very first point, you know, we'll never stop it, but I certainly think we can reduce it. And now, looking at the roles of technology, taking cash out of the system, it's something that, you know, a lot of industries are moving to. And certainly that was one of the areas that, interestingly, COVID-19 changed. Cash handling, you know, so many shops wouldn't accept cash because of the contamination issues. And so the whole thing went over to much more contact payments and things like that, and, you know, payments on your smartphones. So I think that was an interesting thing that happened out of COVID-19. As much as it caused a lot of issues around procurement, I think it created the need for people to revisit how they actually operated, particularly around the cash. So I think, you know, what we can look at globally is where there have been successes in education, in training, in technology, in whistleblowing and reporting hotlines, and also how people are, you know, investigating corruption and actually, you know, taking these as lessons. I think one thing I always think, there's no magic bullet. And as much as you can look at a case study or an interesting piece of technology or an application that somebody else has done, you know, it has to be tailored to your organisation, to your culture, to your legislation and everything else. But I think if you can take pieces of all of the pieces of best practice that have been identified, then I think there's a lot in there for people to put together a strong anti-corruption strategy and actually work more intelligently in reducing corruption.
Thanks, John. That was my last question. Thank you for joining us today on CIPFA Speaks and sharing your insights into the fight against corruption.
Well, thank you very much again for the opportunity. Thank you.
That was John Baker discussing anti-fraud and corruption. Up next, we'll hear from Nieves Zuniga, who is a research and evaluation consultant.
Today, I'm speaking with Nieves Zuniga, an independent research consultant and expert on matters of anti-corruption. Thanks for joining us today for this episode.
Thank you for having me, Cal.
And for our listeners unfamiliar with your research and your background, would you mind sharing a little bit about your experience and your work?
Sure. I started working on anti-corruption in 2014 when I got a postdoc research position at the University of Nottingham to work with Paul Haywood on an EU-funded project called Anticorp, Anti-Corruption Policies Revisited, in collaboration with the University of Birmingham. And our main focus there was to develop an alternative approach to fight corruption, which was based on promoting integrity. One of the questions that we addressed then was, what is the right balance between compliance and values and the promotion of values? And we did two case studies, the case study of Bolivia and Rwanda, because both governments had a strong anti-corruption discourse with the promotion of values as one of the prominent aspects of them. And the other thing we did was to try to make the concept of integrity more practical, because it's a very abstract concept, and try to develop an approach of what it means to integrity management in public life, specifically. As a result of that was the report Integrity and Integrity Management in Public Life. And then after that, I worked as a researcher for Transparency International Secretariat based in Berlin for some years. And one of my main responsibilities there was to be responsible for the research part of another EU-funded project on grand corruption and state capture in the Western Balkans and Turkey.
All right, thanks for that. And you certainly do have an interesting, comprehensive background in research. Now, listeners hopefully will have seen on our social media channels at CIPFA that we recently published a new compendium of global case studies, all of which are focused on anti-corruption prevention. And one of these case studies featured in that compendium is your work that you completed together with Paul Haywood, which you just mentioned, which is focused on zero tolerance initiatives in Bolivia. Would you mind giving a short overview of that particular case in South America and maybe discuss a little bit the positive outcomes for the country?
Sure. So the case of Bolivia is very interesting because, as I said, they had, during the government of Evo Morales, they had a strong anti-corruption discourse, and they put a lot of emphasis on the question of values. This is why it was one of our cases that we wanted to study. But when I went to Bolivia to do the fieldwork, the reality was a different thing. And Bolivia has a systematic problem of corruption. It's a highly corrupt country. Corruption is at many different levels. But when I was there interviewing people, there were many people that they were saying that there was an exception, which was the municipal government in La Paz. La Paz is one of the main cities in Bolivia where the government sits and is the where the government sits. So since many people were saying, putting that exception, it sounded like it was an island of integrity in a highly corrupt context. And I wanted to know more, what was the explanation for that? What happened there was that in 1989, it was elected Juan del Granado as mayor of La Paz. And he had a very interesting approach to fight corruption. La Paz was a highly corrupt city. And he, from 2000 and 2002, he established what it was called a policy of terror to reduce corruption. And the dynamic there was shoot first and ask questions later. So it was that tough hand against corruption. But it was not only that. That was for the first 2 years. After 2002, they implemented a comprehensive anti-corruption policy with three main components. One of them was to work from the judiciary to implement sanctions based on legal evidence against corruption. The second component was economic recovery, and that meant mainly reordering and cleaning the tax system. And the third component was to work on the institutionalization of the municipal government and decentralizing the activities to sub-city halls. So something that they did was they created transparency units and they created continuous improvement units, which were mainly units to help citizens to deal with bureaucracy. So they were very much driven to help the citizens how to do the paperwork and to establish a transparency policy in everything related to bureaucracy. But something very interesting happened in 2002, which was a flood in La Paz, where many people died, many people lost their houses, and it was a quite traumatic situation. And that was important for anti-corruption policy because something changed in the mind of the citizens and in the mind of the public servants when that happened. Del Granado put all his team to the service of the people, to help the people in a very dramatic situation. And that really changed the way citizens perceive public servants, not anymore as people who want only their own interests, but people that can help them. And they show their appreciation for that. And also in the mind of the public servants, that meant to feel proud to work for a public institution that was really making a difference in the life of people. So that shift from being political agents to agents of public transformation was a very important aspect of the success in La Paz.
No, that's a really interesting example. I mean, you know, you mentioned an island and a, you know, seemingly a municipal island in a country that's very, very corrupt. I think at CIPFA, a lot of times we talk about, you know, fighting corruption isn't just about investigations and enforcement. It's also about prevention, integrity, kind of looking at the positive and people genuinely doing the right thing, and transparency. And I think that's a really interesting, you know, some takeaways there from Bolivia. So with that in mind, we're in a seemingly ever continuing almost period of political and economic volatility in the world. And at the same time, with declining levels of public trust in many countries. So how would you apply the learnings from your work in Bolivia into today's current event context? I mean, how is it relevant, not just in South America, but also in other country contexts in Europe and Asia and North America and things like that?
Sure. So I think the key here is to reflect on that balance between compliance and values, and especially what it means integrity management, right? Which is something that I think in the case of La Paz, they manage it quite successfully. In the report Integrity and Integrity Management in Public Life that I mentioned earlier, we present five key variables for an effective approach to integrity management. And one of them is context. In context of systematic corruption, talking only about values probably is not going to work. It's not going to be effective because the priority might be enforcing respect for rules. But in a context where public officials are trustworthy, to respond to corruption scandals with more compliance, that might not be advisable because that might create division within the public service and some discourse about us versus them attitudes, right? So, and create also conflicts of interest. So context is very important. Another key variable is timing or sequencing. And we saw that in the case of La Paz, tough measures first to regain the credibility of the institution because nobody believed in the municipal government before. And through those tough years with zero tolerance, they regained the credibility, but followed by a comprehensive approach. So timing is important. Another one is diversity of measures. Not everybody responds to this in the same way to, for example, codes of conduct. Some public servants might believe in them, some of them might completely ignore them, some of them they don't know what to do depending on the situation or on the need in that particular moment. So that's an important aspect as well. And also a mutual reinforcement between rules and values is important. For example, if local authorities are seen in a society as providers, it might not be a good idea to include anti-corruption rules that limit their capacity to provide. So rules and values should reinforce each other. And finally, partnership. A partnership between authorities and citizens working towards the same goal. And here is very important the aspect that you mentioned, Carl, about credibility and trust. I remember in Bolivia, something that I heard often was, if they do it, meaning if politicians, if the government do corruption, why I shouldn't do it, right? So we want to avoid that, and we want to be governments and citizens on the same page working towards the same goal.
Right. And I think that's something that I've seen a lot here at SIPFA with the work that we've done linked to anti-corruption and counter-frauds. You know, sequencing is important, unique measures for the local context. And I really like that last point that you mentioned, you kind of have a mutual focus on both values and also rules. So, you know, Nieves, your background is very international, and a lot of the work that we've done together is focused internationally. But if you don't mind, I'd like to get your thoughts on something UK focused for a minute. So our British listeners will be well aware of the British Chancellor's new budget, or autumn statement rather, that recently came out. It's clear that for the UK in particular, our public finances are in a pretty dire state. Based on your broader understanding of fraud and corruption, and your research experience, what impact would you say that this has on the future of corrupt activity in the UK?
Yeah, so I think it's important. I mean, I'm not an expert on the UK situation, but my reflection on this will be that it's important not to isolate the financial situation from the political instability and the lower levels of trust towards the British democracy and the public officials that have been increasing recently. I think we need to take the whole situation as a whole. And I think the risks of corruption there increase because when the democratic project, for example, has cracks, or there is lack of credibility or lack of trust on those leading the democratic project, or even in how the democratic project is evolving, the increase of corruption there is to think more on the self-interest rather than in the public good that democratic project might represent. So when there is this instability, I think that the risk of corruption comes from thinking of, okay, I need to think of myself, on protecting my interest, right? Which is basically what corruption is to put self-interest before the public good. Right. And there is also an increase, in my opinion, of undue influence in this kind of situations. Because the system is, when the system is weak or is broken, there might be some actors who might be thinking of shaping the system to one's interests, right? In a situation of these characteristics. And actually here, for example, Transparency International UK was calling for reinforcing integrity in the public service and ensuring the highest standards in government, because if there is not integrity, there is not going to be credibility and trust. Therefore, there is not going to be partnership, the partnership that we were talking before, and the self-interest might become first for some people.
Right, so it comes back to kind of trust and transparency, I think. And I'm assuming as well, it's not, you know, the current situation in the UK, but also these ideas can be very relevant for countries also going through, you know, their own periods of austerity as well.
Right, exactly. That applies in many contexts, unfortunately, right now.
All right, so on that happy note, Nieves, I think we'll wrap up the conversation here, but just want to say it's been a very timely discussion, and it's always interesting to see learnings from one country applied to other country contexts. So thank you very much for your time and for joining us on SIPFA Speaks.
Thank you very much, Carl, and thank you for having me.
That was Nieves Zuniga, who is a research and evaluation consultant, discussing anti-fraud and corruption. Up next, we'll hear from SIPFA's own Ellie Roy and Andy Burns, who discuss SIPFA's new Integrating Care publication that will be released on the 5th of December. Today, I'm joined by Ellie Roy, who is SIPFA's Health and Social Care Policy Manager, and Andy Burns, who is Associate Director at SIPFA. We're here today to discuss the new report that's being released by SIPFA on the 5th of December. The report is called Integrating Care, Policy, Principles and Practice for Places, and it focuses on integrating care. Thank you both for joining me here today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So my first question is, could you tell us a bit about the new Integrating Care publication? How did it come about and why?
So SICFA have long believed that a whole system approach is necessary for the closer integration of health and care. And the Health and Care Act that passed earlier this year brought a renewed focus onto integration. And that presents an opportunity for NHS and local government partners to truly take a different approach to these partnerships. Taking a truly place-based approach focused on the wider determinants of population health and wellbeing, which is an emphasis in prevention, could make a huge contribution to achieving the aims of integration and improving the outcomes for population health. So the Act has succeeded in providing a new architecture for health and care integration, putting integrated care boards and partnerships on a statutory footing. But at place level, the Act makes no provision at all. The government set out their intentions for place-based partnerships in a white paper in February, but that actually asked more questions, we thought, than it answered. And a lot of those challenges were related to public financial management. So as the body dedicated to public services and financial management, SICFA committed to supporting and empowering partners in health and local government by seeking to address some of these challenges. And that's what we've aimed to do in this publication.
If I can maybe just add to what Ellie has said there, and thinking about public financial management in its wider sense, not just about health and care. I think that whole systems approach at its heart is an understanding that in order to improve outcomes, you know, the health and well-being of the population in this case, that can be enhanced by working across organisational boundaries, recognising the interconnectedness of partners involved and the greater impact they can have through closer collaboration rather than just working in competition, which was a feature of the, if you like, the NHS legislation prior to this statutory underpinning for integration.
Fantastic. What does the report focus on? I know there's quite an emphasis on place, but what does it focus on and how is it going to help integrating care to move forward?
So I think we really intended this publication to inform, to influence and to support a dual audience, if you like. So both central government departments and practitioners on the ground at place level and indeed in the wider systems. So we've tried to structure the publication to be informative and provide an overview of the changes that have come about as a result of the 2022 Act, a lot of them being quite structural in nature. We also looked at what closer integration is now seeking to achieve, because I think that's evolved over time and how it's progressed to date, because it's been happening for a couple of decades now. It's not a new thing. We also looked at integration in the context of the wider landscape across health and care, because there's a lot of policy around at the moment and a lot of reforms on the table. And in the current climate, obviously, things are a bit tight financially and there's a lot of pressures on both the NHS and local government. And then finally, we wanted to address, as I said, some of these challenges remaining at the level of the place-based partnerships, which we see as being the engine room, if you like, for integrating care. And a lot of these challenges are around how the partnerships operate in terms of what their overall outcomes are, what their governance arrangements are, and what their finance mechanisms are, which may sound quite distant from the aims of integrating care, but we firmly believe that these arrangements need to be in place in a sound and robust manner to enable the relationships and the trust and the service changes that need to happen in the future.
And again, just to add, I mean, in terms of helping integration move forward, there's going to be key roles to play for finance leaders in both local government and the NHS. And at the moment, there's a plethora of guidance from a range of different sources. And the hope here is actually, if you're a senior finance practitioner in local government or the NHS, the place to look for the best source of that guidance is this SICFA publication. And it will talk about some of the key finance and governance challenges. And as I'm sure we'll talk about later in more detail, signposts to frameworks or approaches that could be used to ensure in moving more closely together to collaboration to improve the health and well-being of population rather than just manage sort of illness and care of patients and service users. You do that with an eye on the principles of good public financial management, good governance and delivery of value for money.
And perhaps unusually for one of our insight reports like this, we have made a series of recommendations and also included quite a number of case studies, which we hope will be helpful to central government in developing future policy on integration and the guidance that they've committed to produce next year for place-based partnerships, as well as Andy said, providing support for the finance practitioner at local level.
So this year, we're coming to the end of the year now, but this year there have been a lot of governmental shifts. Do you feel that integrating care has been given enough attention in government, or is there a risk of it being overlooked?
Yeah, I think, firstly, it's a good question, and I think it's spot on. But it's probably a function of the landscape that the NHS and councils, particularly with care responsibilities, are facing. I think the intention is to move forward on the integration agenda, but actually the reality is it's being crowded out by other pressures and priorities. So in the NHS, we hear about elective care backlogs, we hear about difficulty in getting access to GPs, delays in ambulance services. And in local authorities, those councils with social care responsibilities have been concerned about the implementation of the new social care reforms. Now, they've now been postponed in the autumn statement. So potentially, as we move into a different place, the intention and the attention of government and NHS and local government partners can focus on the integration agenda. And it was interesting and significant that in the autumn statement, the Chancellor announced there's going to be a review of the operation of integrated care systems to be chaired by Patricia Hewitt, who's both a former health secretary under the previous Labour administration and a current chair of an integrated care system. I think it's in Norfolk and Waverley. So I think that shows that maybe the government are recognising that the progress that has been made hasn't been at the pace they would have intended. And this review, I think, maybe might give it some renewed focus and impetus.
I would agree with that. I would also agree that although there has been some attention paid to integration or elements of integration, sometimes the messaging around it, while the intention is welcome, sometimes the messaging around it can be unhelpful. So, for example, in the autumn statement, we saw additional funding or funding being diverted for social care, delay of the reforms and more funding being put in to provide additional care packages to improve hospital discharge. Now, more money for social care is always welcome, but because that's ring-fenced, if you like, quite a lot of it for hospital discharge, it does little to alleviate existing pressures in social care. And it also fails to recognise that there are other factors which contribute to delayed discharge. It's not just social care. Things like the lack of availability of sufficient community health care. So it seems to reflect the view of social care as a service whose role is to alleviate pressures on hospitals, which can add tensions to those discussions, conversations and relationships required for closer integration. Where I've been a little bit disappointed this year is that in the February white paper, we saw an emphasis on the importance of place and prevention. And we haven't heard very much in the remainder of the year about either of those factors. Similarly, we had a commitment to a white paper on addressing health inequalities, another area that's key to improving population health and integrating care. That hasn't yet emerged, and it remains uncertain as to whether it ever will emerge. And these, again, they're issues that are fundamentally important to closer integration. So the silence in those issues, whilst understandable because of the fluctuations, if you like, in government, they are missing. I think a key issue that we highlight in the publication is the apparent disconnect between the short and the longer term. So as Andy said, the focus has tended to be on the immediate pressures of urgent and emergency care and the elective backlog. And while we are pouring attention and resource into those short-term pressures, we are not achieving the longer-term vision or the longer-term commitment required to achieve that vision. And in the paper, we suggest that we need to be taking a twin-track approach. If we don't want to be firefighting going forward into the future, we need sufficient commitment and certainty of funding to ensure that we can do both, to address these immediate challenges, but also the long-term preventative investment that we need to ensure that these services are sustainable into the future.
So what progress has been made since the Health and Care Act was passed? And do you think that the passing of that act has given integrating care the impetus that is needed?
It's probably given it a foundation to build on rather than necessarily impetus. I mentioned in the previous answer about the review announced in the autumn statement, which Patricia Hewitt will chair. So that might give a further boost, if you like. I think that the progress across the country of ICSs having been established, now chairs being put in place, chief execs being put in place, boards starting to get to grips with what's going on in their locality, I think is all good stuff. But I think this is a long term issue rather than just a short term issue. And I think the foundations have been laid and they need to be built upon, to use that sort of metaphor, rather than sort of, I don't know, it's winter and you can't get the builders in to come in to do the next sort of phase because of the bad weather. Now, winter pressures potentially in the NHS typically do cause an absolute focus on delayed hospital discharges at the expense of other things. But potentially having different sets of people around the integrated care partnership table, including those from local authorities and the voluntary sector, not just NHS, potentially will keep the focus and the pressure on to ensure there is scope to look at the wider determinants of health and well-being of populations rather than just being focused on the immediate.
I absolutely agree. I think you're right. The structures are, you know, established, and I think it's certainly added impetus. It's certainly opened up the conversation and the opportunity to work differently. And I've yet to speak to anybody involved that doesn't want to do the right thing, if you like, in terms of integrating care. One of the key themes that came out in our work is the extent of variation across England, not only between integrated care systems, but also even within the places of a single system. So I think when we talk about progress, we need to recognise that variation. And it's not a function of the maturity of a place or a system necessarily. It's not a negative thing. I think it's necessary because local circumstances are different from place to place, and how the partnerships and the relationships have developed over time is also significantly different. So I think it's necessary because each locality and its needs are unique, but we need to understand that variation, and we need to understand that integrating care is not a big bang event that's going to happen overnight. It's an evolutionary process, and because of the variation inherent in the process, they're not all going to evolve in the same direction or at the same rate. So I think we need to manage expectations a little bit and be realistic about what can be achieved within a reasonable time and the available resources in each area. And this variation is part of the reason why in our publication we have talked about a principles-based framework to underpin these place-based partnerships, because formulating your arrangements in that way means that they remain adaptable to change as systems evolve and develop differently from each other.
So local government, both upper and lower tier councils, all have a vital role to play in integrating care. Why is this, and what should local government be doing to promote and practice integrating care?
Okay, so I think in the same way we've talked about place not being homogenous, neither is local government. And I think there are two key tiers and two key differences. So for the upper tier councils and unitary councils, those who have statutory responsibility for adult social care and public health, they will understandably want to be involved in shaping the strategy and the direction of the priorities for integrated care partnerships in their place. And many are doing that and sitting around those top tables. But I think for district and borough councils who don't have those direct responsibilities, but they do hold some of the key levers to improve health and well-being of populations, so particularly around housing and leisure and amenity. And also, in addition, I'm aware that some district and borough councils, rather than wishing to be involved in the sort of strategic management and commissioning of health and well-being services, they want to hold the integrated care partnerships and boards to account on behalf of their citizens and residents, and don't necessarily want to be involved in the direct management and leadership of these new integrated care boards. So I think there are some differences which are really, really key. Top tier, who've got such a responsibility for health, for social care, and that's where the attention often is, you know, frail elderly discharges and public health prevention. But actually, no, district and borough councils in the two-tier areas across the majority of sort of the non-metropolitan parts of the country have different roles, holding key levers, but also an important scrutiny role to hold the system to account. And I'm not sure that's always been fully understood and is fully recognised in some of the guidance that we've seen from NHS England, but is at the heart of what SIPFA's guidance talks about in terms of how do you get the different tiers of the government playing the part that they're best able to play in taking these arrangements forward.
I would absolutely agree with that. I think there needs to be a bit of a wider understanding that population health is not just about healthcare. In fact, healthcare is only a very small part of health and wellbeing. So when it comes to those wider social determinants of health, the role that the NHS can play is actually quite limited. It just doesn't have the range of influence. It doesn't hold the right keys, if you like. Whereas councils do hold those levers to influence, you know, the wider determinants of health and wellbeing. Things like housing, the local environment, local economy, green spaces, leisure services, active travel. As we've seen in the headlines recently, quality housing can have a significant impact on, you know, not just the individual's health and wellbeing, but that of the local population. So councils are key voices to have around the table, not just in the integrated care partnerships, but also at the level of delivery at these, you know, they're key players in these place-based partnerships. They also have a huge knowledge of their local area and engaging with the local populations, whereas the NHS tends to do things more on a national level. So that knowledge and experience is critical to understanding and meeting the needs of the local populations. So I would echo what Andy said. I think all levels of local government have critical roles to play, both in the partnerships and at place level.
So when is the report going to be released and where can people find it?
So we will be publishing the report on the 5th of December and it will be available on the SIPFA website, where we have some dedicated integrating care pages. So sipfa.integratingcare, I think, or similar. I'm sure that we will be sending out links far and wide via social media and other channels on Monday morning.
Great. Well, I think that's a great place to end. Thank you both very much for joining me today on SIPFA Speaks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Burns discussing SIPFA's latest integrating care publication that will be released on the 5th of December. That's all we've got time for on today's episode. To find out more about SIPFA's anti-fraud compendium or to access the integrating care publication, please visit SIPFA's website, sipfa.org. You can also follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find previous episodes of SIPFA Speaks on our website or wherever you like to listen. We wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we will be back with you in January. Thanks for listening and goodbye.